Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota in Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit Toyota on nicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at lexusoflexington.com. Did you know that half of America is single? Hollywood has never produced anything like this before. The Dating Project, a groundbreaking documentary that follows five single people, ages 18 to 40, as they search for authentic and meaningful relationships. There is no script. There are no actors. These are real people trying to find love and happiness in an age of swiping left or right. From Empower Pictures, Paulist Productions, Family Theater Productions, and PureFlix, you can now own The Dating Project. Save the date by visiting thedatingprojectmovie.com and go a step further and help others in your circle date differently by partnering with Ascension Press. Visit shop.ascensionpress.com to acquire the companion study guide. The Dating Project movie is now available on DVD and digital download on Amazon, iTunes, and Walmart. Please visit thedatingprojectmovie.com for details.
Hey, good evening to you. Welcome to Beneath the Surface, where faith and reason meets every Monday evening between 10 and 11 p.m. here at WCAP Radio. Here to bring a little sanity into our age of insanity, a little life into our culture of death. Tonight, ladies and gentlefolks, our topic of the evening is discerning the truth and all of its obstacles. How do we do it? What is it? Why bother? All of those things and much more are going to be talked about tonight, but if you would like to talk about that with us or give a little flavor or change of topic of your own, feel free. Give us a call. 978-454-4980 is our BTS hotline. That's 978-454-4980. Before I introduce to you my guest for this evening, how about our producer of the evening? We haven't talked to her since it's been several weeks.
Yeah, how you doing?
Great. How are you?
I'm feeling wonderful.
Okay, that's awesome. You feeling better since the last time, the second to the last time I saw you?
Yeah, I can actually. It feels nice to have oxygen going in and out of my lungs.
That is awesome.
And it feels weird sometimes, but it's cool.
When it's what?
It feels weird sometimes, but it's cool.
You're not used to it.
You're right. I'm not used to it, so I have to just go with the flow.
So Cindy had a little procedure done, and she breathes better, and she feels a lot better, and that is awesome. It kind of reminds me of somebody who was, not this dramatic, obviously, but somebody who was blind from birth who just began to see. You don't really have any reference to it, but you know it feels good, right?
Exactly.
Fantastic. That's Miss Cindy, our producer, and you know as well as I do, Cindy's Vinyl Vault comes up right after Beneath the Surface here Monday evenings at 11 p.m. After we take off, we listen to her on the way home with Cindy and Peter. That's Cindy's Vinyl Vault. So, across from me, there he is, ladies and gentlemen.
Here I am.
My second week of the month guest and yours, Mr. Bob LeBlanc.
Hello, Paul.
What is it like being you?
It's like being me. Is that circular?
That's circular.
Gee, we probably should talk about circular reasoning there.
Yes.
But, you know, it's pretty tough to because I have no idea what people really want to know about what it is being me.
Well, usually when people say, you know, want us to say a little something about yourself, you usually go into the superficial things.
Yes.
I do this for work. I live in this town. And, of course, my name is. But it doesn't really give us the what it really means, or what the experience of being Bob.
Okay, now that you've explained that, I think I am a lover of truth.
Ooh.
Or probably maybe more accurately, a lover of wisdom.
Then how can somebody not want to be your friend?
I don't know.
It's impossible not to, if you are truly a lover of truth and a lover of wisdom.
Well, the thing is that I'm an imperfect person, you know.
You can't have everything.
Yeah, but I mean, I do know that I have my foibles, the weaknesses.
Yes.
That, you know, I may not practice what I preach all the time.
Well, name me one person besides Jesus Christ and the Blessed Virgin that has always practiced what they preach.
Well, with the qualifier always, I think probably zero.
Right, so you are in...
Except when we're talking about, you know, the Father and the Holy Spirit,
right.
Which are also persons.
Well, anyway, you are in big company in our post-Eden world, and we have to realize we're in a post-Eden world. So we're going to be imperfect in how we act and how we live, but I think a huge demarcation point, if you will, is what the show is all about tonight.
Yes.
In your perfection, are you seeking truth or are you not?
I'm definitely seeking truth.
Okay, and that puts you in the category of, I think, goodness.
Yeah.
The person who seeks truth is very attractive. They are doing what they are meant to do, to seek, to understand, and conform to the truth.
Right. Yes. You know, several months ago, we did this show based off of Joseph Pieper's book, Abusive Language, Abusive Power.
Yeah.
And one of the things that stuck with me is that this has been a long time problem. The problem that he was talking about, which was Socrates versus the sophists.
Right.
And they were calling themselves wise.
Yeah.
Which sophist, the root word, goes to. And philosophers choose instead the love of wisdom, not trying to say that they are wise
themselves. Yes.
But rather say,
and as Socrates says, those who believe they're wise are fools.
There is, yes.
And those who believe they're fools very often are wise.
And Socrates made a big thing out of about a saying, I don't know. You know, he had that one virtue which I think is primarily important for discerning the truth,
yeah,
is humility.
That's interesting you say that, because whenever I ask a question to a student pointedly, and they sit there and they say, I don't know, I congratulate them.
Uh-huh.
I say that is a beautiful answer. I love that answer.
Well, I wonder, though, if it's an I don't know out of indifference. You know, I have no care about the topic that you're talking about.
I don't want to participate. No, in these cases, they're truly, sincerely engaged.
Okay.
And when I get to the... And I try to teach Socratically in my classes.
Uh-huh.
So when I get to a question, you know, following reason, that they honestly don't know, and when they tell me, they instead of trying to sort of fake it and use fluffy words to to maybe sound like they almost know and all of that nonsense, just to say, I honestly don't know. I say, great, that's a great answer.
Okay.
That's a true answer.
I should practice that myself more often.
Sure.
But the reason why I brought that up, I had another thing I was thinking about, this, and I thought, you know, there is something an important way to distinguish between sophists and humble people who are seeking the truth.
Okay.
And a person who's seeking the truth, when he gets into a dialogue or an argument or something of that nature, the whole purpose that he sees what he's doing is to arrive at the truth, you know, no matter which way goes. You want it to arrive. And a sophist, and this is historically true, sophists taught people how to win arguments.
Yeah. All right, so let me clarify that for everybody, because this is so important. There are two ways to argue. And I don't mean argue as in with anger. I just mean philosophically argue, discuss issues. Number one is to try to win. The aim, the end, the goal is to win the argument. That's the sophist.
Yes.
The other way is to see the other as not an opponent, but as a as somebody who is on your team, seeking together to try to come closer and closer to the truth, which is objective. And that's the second way to argument. So the second way, the aim is truth itself, not to win the argument, but to attain more truth and clarity. That would be the humble way to argue.
Yeah.
Socrates' way.
Yes. Mm. And in a way, I've kind of cut a whole bunch of stuff that I wanted to talk about first, but
maybe
you can backtrack a little bit.
Go ahead. What did you want to mention?
Well, I wanted to talk about trusting the senses. Because
The five senses. Yeah.
The five senses, because I think everybody agrees with our knowledge beginning with the senses.
Everybody except for radical skeptics, but yes.
Yes. But there are, I think, maybe subtle differences as you kind of move around, if you're a materialist or not. So one of the phrases that a friend of mine long time ago used to bring up all the time is, trust is the coin of the realm. And I thought, well, that's kind of cute. But then when I actually thought about it, I'm going, that really applies in so many different areas.
Okay.
And one is just trusting your senses. And I say this with a caveat of knowing that our senses are not 100% reliable. And so there's always maybe an understanding of our limitations. And I guess we didn't really actually talk about humility, but...
Yes, we did.
Well, we did, but we didn't talk about what humility is.
Well, let's do one thing at a time. Let's finish the senses before we get on to humility. So God and nature has given us five senses for us to detect reality around us.
Right.
Unless you're a Cartesian-like skeptic, you will trust your senses. We begin life as children trusting our five senses.
Right.
We don't second guess and say, how do I know my eyes are telling me the truth? or what I'm feeling is wrong, or what I'm hearing is really there. We sort of just intuitively trust our... So that's what we have to begin with as a premise. That we begin life and continue unless we become like a very skeptical person, we do trust our senses.
Well, it's so important to trust our senses because it comes to the next step, I think, in trust. And by the way, I think I could use faith and trust interchangeably here,
yes.
I think, because faith, I mean by faith, I mean by trusting.
Mm.
Not accepting things blindly, but there is a little bit of blindness to this, because the next thing that we need to trust is other people
and their senses.
And their senses, in particular, if you're a little child,
you've got to
trust your parents.
Yeah,
it's so important because the parents are your first teachers.
Hmm.
You know, and you know, when they say something, I think that bond of trust is very important. You learn some basic skills from that.
Well, actually, we begin trusting somebody else even before ourselves, and that's our mothers to feed us.
Right, right.
We actually begin trusting our mothers, you know, without a doubt. A baby trusts his mother to feed him. But Yes. I think what you're saying is that trust goes beyond the realm of the self to others. And as we get older, I think you're about to say, we need to, and more mature, we need to discern who best to trust and who not to trust. Yes?
Yes. Yes. Well, you know, as you start moving away from your family and you start moving out into the world, the next people, at least in the United States, that you trust is a teacher in a public school or maybe a private school or something of that order. And they're giving you information, and you can't be, and I don't think there are any child skeptics at this age. There's just an implicit trust that whatever the teacher is saying is true.
Okay. It depends on the age, but yeah, elementary school, probably trusting.
And the knowledge that you're getting is fairly basic sort of stuff, like they're teaching you how to read.
Yeah.
You know, they're not going to say that the word think means is spelled L-U-V-E or something like that. They're teaching some pretty basic sort of things that you need to learn.
Which is objectively good. The problem I have, though, is the subtleties and the spin by which they teach things today.
Well, there is that. I think that happens when you get into the more complicated topics rather than the elementary school topics. I'm not sure. There could be. Maybe ideology has gotten so bad that, you know, referring to nouns and verbs is oppression by the patriarchy.
I think it's getting worse and worse, and I think you're going to see things like gender-neutral pronouns and all of that kind of stuff, and not calling people boys and girls, even in elementary school. I think that's how bad it is going to get soon.
That is going to break down trust, which will break down our society, our civilization. You need a basic level of trust, and I'm hearing the music here.
The music you're hearing, so talk over it.
Okay.
But only for about 20 seconds and no more.
Oh, okay.
See, that's how this works. You hear the music, you talk a little bit, and then we say, we're going to take a break, ladies and gentlemen.
It interrupts my train of thought.
Yeah?
Anyways, yes. Yeah, let me regather after the break.
Regather those thoughts.
Yes.
All right. You're listening to Beneath the Surface here at WCAP Radio. We're here until 11 p.m. If you want to get in touch with us, 978-454-4980. Paul Morano with my guest Bob LeBlanc tonight, and we will be talking to you after this break. We're back. Are you back? That is the question. Because we certainly are. And if you're back enough to give us a call and join in on the conversation, 978-454-4980 is our BTS hotline, 978-454-4980. So, we're back, Mr. Bobbert.
I am back.
Before the break... by the way, our topic tonight on Beneath the Surface is discerning the truth, how to do it, and its obstacles. And before the break, Bob, we talked about that discerning the truth begins with, you said, trust. Trust in your senses, trust in your immediate environment of others, your parents, for example. As life goes on, trust in professionals like teachers and doctors.
Yes.
And then as life goes on, don't we begin to, after the age of reason and beyond, begin to trust our own reasoning power?
Yes, yes. There was an interesting article that I read in preparation for this. It talked about whether we should tell children about Santa Claus.
Ooh, tell me about it.
I've taken the position that you shouldn't because it's a lie, you know, you shouldn't lie. And
I didn't know you took that position.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
Pretty much. I've not been really vocal about it or anything like that. This article took the position and said, well, there are some benefits in doing so because what they do is that they teach your children to be more critical. It provides an opportunity for them to be more critical. What they discerned was that children, as you just said, they start developing some critical skills, judgment and evaluation of other people's arguments, you know. And some of the things that they observed were, you know, like if a zookeeper started talking about various animals, they would find the zookeeper to be credible. But if it was like a chef or somebody that was not in that field of expertise, they would be a little more skeptical of it. So they're evaluating the person according to what they should know or shouldn't know according to their occupation or expertise.
You know, that's there's good and there's bad in that.
Yeah.
The good is that the fundamental obvious part, which is if you have a particular position, you probably should know a good amount about it.
Right.
The bad part is what Socrates uncovered with Euthyphro, in that so-called experts very often don't know what they're talking about.
Well,
or they're filled with so much ideology that they have missed all semblance of wisdom regarding their topic.
Well, that brings me into a segue here, I guess.
Let us segue.
Another article talked about, can you cheat? There's a catchphrase, you know, and if you ask me what it means, I'll tell you I don't know, because most people don't know what it means.
All right.
And that phrase is critical thinking.
All right.
There are a lot of people who use it, and they kind of mean their own kind of subjective thing, what it means. But anyways, this going forth and talking, this article was talking about general critical thinking, and what they discovered is that when you talk about skills that are more developed, like they examined the thinking skills of air traffic controllers, which They have to have what they called a situational awareness. You have to be aware of what's going around you. And they tried to discern whether these air traffic controllers could use these skills in other similar applications, and what they found was no. Even though they had all these critical skills of being able to juggle all these airplanes in the air at a very, very fast pace, weren't able to translate that.
Wait, I'm confused. They weren't able to do what?
Well, to use it in other areas other than air traffic controlling, these sorts of skills. I think the best maybe would be clearer for you is if I said, well, we see a lot of times scientists who have doctorates, they're very intelligent, and then they try to do philosophy. And they sound really stupid to you and I because we have, I think, maybe a better exposure to philosophy than they have.
Okay.
And they tend to think, well, I know about this method of thinking, therefore...
Or how about, well, even more radical, the secular media commenting on religious issues?
Yes, there are a lot of times when
they make absolute fools of themselves.
Yeah, they it's obvious that they don't know about the religion that they're talking about in many times. You can detect that. So yes, but so there is this kind of thing where certain skills are not translatable into different fields.
Okay.
But there is, I think, a general critical thinking kind of tool that we have that I think applies no matter where you go.
The power of reason?
I'm talking about logic.
Okay.
Old-fashioned Aristotelian logic, classical logic, where...
So logic objectively is able to detect truth.
Well, it's a tool. I mean, it's not the only thing. Going further afield here, I think what you need, context really matters a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
So having the tool of logic is not very useful unless you have...
If you begin with the right premises.
Well, yes. You need, if you're going to discern whether a particular piece of history is true, you need to know history. You need to know the context of history that you're talking about.
Right.
Otherwise, logic is not
right.
going to help
Same
you at
thing
all.
With literature and art and all those things.
Right. So you need a sort of understanding of whatever field that you're talking about.
Okay. And a lot of people would say the Constitution is the same way. If you don't understand the times of the 18th century and
right.
the intent and what the founding fathers really meant by those words, then you're not constitutional.
Right.
You're just making up your own.
Well, yes. And people sometimes think they know when they just know a little bit, and that's another sort of pitfall. I think you mentioned the Constitution. I think there should be taught in schools if we're going to go there. I mean, we talk about reading and writing.
Yeah.
Arithmetic, basic things, maybe science, and definitely we do need at some level an education in civics.
Okay.
You know.
So getting back to our main point here, discerning the truth. So far, you're saying that it begins with trust, and we begin life with trust. We know that we trust our mothers, we trust our parents, and we begin life trusting our own five senses that they actually detect reality and truth, and then we trust people around us, like teachers, friends, other professionals, like doctors. After the age of reason, we begin to trust our own thinking and our own understanding of things. Let me ask you this, and I'll ask you this in the spirit of René Descartes when he was going through his thing. Why should I trust my five senses and my power of logic? Why should I?
Yeah, it's if you're not trusting your senses, then it seems like you're not going to be really capable of living.
Well,
except in a bearish sort of sense.
But a skeptic with that would say, okay, I'll follow what my senses tell me just to get by.
Uh-huh.
But I don't really trust that it's telling me anything objectively true. How would you combat that? How can I trust that my five senses and my reasoning power can actually detect what is objectively true outside of myself?
Well,
why should I?
Well, you're making an objective truth statement right there by saying I can't trust my senses.
Well, I'm actually didn't say that. I asked the question, why should I?
Oh, why should you?
Yeah.
I'd have to think about that. Yeah.
You know, the argument goes, if my senses and my reasoning power, the materialist argument would go this way. If my brain and my senses are simply the result of millions of years of random, senseless evolution with no intelligence behind it, then why should I trust that these senses that make up me detect anything that's true?
Well, it makes relations impossible, really.
You're answering it from a consequentialist point of view, though.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that you can take any sort of actions based. You're saying you can, but I don't see. Well, I'm going to come up with a consequentialist answer no matter how
you are. That's where you're going.
Yeah.
Wouldn't another answer be that the only way that I can trust these senses of mine is if I believe that I can trust the intelligence behind the design and creation of these senses?
Well, it sounds to me that this person is not going to believe in a designer or anything like that.
Well, if they're materialistic, right, they can't. And then you'll just have to say to them, without God, what you're saying might make sense, that you can't trust your senses.
I guess that's one way of dealing with things. I guess I'm going to go into a consequentialist sort of thing again, but here's what I'm saying is that you can't possibly participate with other people, and the reason why is that there's no reason for me, believing in an objective truth, should trust anything that you say, as far as you taking any sort of
position.
Well,
I understand, and I think most postmodernists today would be fine with that. We just don't trust each other. And that makes sense to them because there is no objective truth.
Yeah, and you go into a kind of a radical individualism. Everybody is in their own sort of bubble. Is exactly what I'm trying to fight against here.
Right, but what I'm asking you is it logical? Let's go back to logic. Is it logical to trust our senses and minds and brains if we don't trust the intelligence that designed them?
Yeah, people have not always acted in the most logical fashion, and I'm saying as a preface is that no, I don't see that as a logical position to take, to say that I don't trust my senses in a complete fashion.
No, I don't think you answered my question.
Well, what was your question then?
My question is, does it logically follow that I should trust my senses if I don't believe in an intelligent designer of my senses?
I would say it does not logically follow.
Okay, that's what I'm getting at. So if you don't believe in a God...
But we should go deeper than that, than just making that statement, because...
Well, I don't know if we can go deeper than that, but...
I certainly think we can. The very, very first logical... part of reasoning, the first step in logic that the mind takes is understanding. And if you can't trust your senses, then you can't understand anything.
Perceiving, judging, and perceiving, understanding, and judging. That's what the mind does.
No, well, you're adding a step here. The traditional ones are understanding, judging, and reasoning. I don't mind adding the perception part.
It's Aristotelian. You have to perceive first.
Right, in order to understand.
Right.
Which is going to my point here.
Yeah.
We operate, or the people who don't deny their senses operate as if the world is intelligible.
Yes,
that there is. It's not chaos that we're dealing with. It that there's some sort of order to the world, and that if I look at a thing and I say, "Oh, that's a dog," that truly is. There is such a thing as dogginess.
Yeah,
that we can talk about, and that is relatable to what other people. So that when I perceive a dog and understand that is a dog that I'm talking about, then I'm operating on this sense of trust, as well as that other people will know what I mean when I talk about dogginess or I talk about a particular instance of a dog.
Yes, what you're doing is you're abstracting the essence from the material object that your eyes perceive.
Right.
And coming up with the essence dog. And a lot of creatures can fall under the umbrella of dog. Little tiny poodles, huge St. Bernards, Great Danes, and everything in between. So, yeah, the mind can understand objects because we can understand concepts.
Yes, and which brings us to the base thing where your skeptic is at, is, you know, do I trust my senses?
Yeah.
And... he's trapped in a subjective world. He may be okay with it, but when he talks about a dog, what is he really talking about? You know, is it the person is effectively alone, and that may be a good description of hell for that particular person if they really actually carried out their belief that they couldn't trust their senses.
And there are other people today in the postmodern world that trust their senses but don't trust the mind. In other words, it seems like there are many that bring us back to the realm of the animal world and think we're really nothing different than animals. We perceive objects, and that's all we have, are individual objects that the eyes perceive. We can't really understand their essence, their nature, and all of those things, which, you know, traditionally has been seen as what the human mind is able to do over and above the animal brain.
Right. And that leads to a thing about judgment.
Yes.
There. You know, a person who doesn't trust the mind is not able to say that somebody did something wrong to me, that's not fair.
Right. Right. They can just simply say, that what he did to me was displeasing to me.
Yes, that's the most you can say.
That's the most you can
cannot
say.
Make an objective qualification there and
right.
say
there is no good or evil, right or wrong, truth or falsehood.
A person was just right. acting by their instincts or whatever their chemicals told their brain to tell them what to do.
Yeah, and this is what why so many people are materialists today, because they seek an out to moral responsibility. We'll get to that after the break and a lot more. You're listening to Beneath the Surface here at WCAP Radio. Paul Morano here with my guest this week, Bob LeBlanc. Stick around, quick break, and we'll be back for our final segment. Whoa.
Whoa.
Trying to figure out why Cindy is putting this song here. Okay, listen to the words. I've lived long enough to have learned. Alright, we don't... Unfortunately, we don't have all night. Who does that song, Cindy? Where are you?
That's Billy Joel.
Oh, of course it's Billy Joel. Yes, yes, yes. And very often you choose a song because it relates to what we're talking about, right? We did that? Hello?
I try to get stuff that relates to you.
Okay. No, I was just wondering if that had any relationship.
Well, yeah, because we're talking about trusting people.
Okay, what was the name of that song?
A Matter of Trust.
Ah!
A Matter of Trust. Oh, there you go. There's the connection. Oh,
yes,
boy.
That's what, I was, ding, that's ding, what ding. I was waiting for. There it is. Matter of Trust. 978-454-4980. Trust us by calling us and giving us your 2 cents on this. So, Bob, what is truth?
What is truth?
Yes.
It's conformity with reality.
Thank you. And where does reality come from?
God.
Okay. So the atheist seeks God when he seeks truth.
Yes, that is true. That
okay.
is true.
Even without realizing it.
Without realizing it, if you're a true seeker, you are seeking after God.
Okay. All right, so what is some of the practical stuff you wanted to get to regarding discerning truth?
Oh, okay. Well, one of the things is the practice of listening.
Mm.
What we're seeing quite a bit now, I think, is a quick dismissal of somebody who is not a member of your own tribe or philosophy or religion or whatever it may be. I see it mostly in politics. It seems to be centered around there. Everything is becoming kind of ideological. But a good instance would be somebody says something, you know, and they don't agree with what was being said. I think a classic example was, I don't know if you remember, when Ben Affleck was on, who's that guy's show there, Bill Maher?
Oh, yeah.
Sam Harris was talking about bad things about Islam. He thought that Islam was... a very hostile religion or
okay.
whatever, and Ben Affleck just replied to him and said, that's racist.
Right.
You know, so and it seems very often people take the position, I don't understand what it is that you're saying, therefore, since I can't understand it, it must be hateful, rather than trying to actually say, go past your admission that you don't understand and try to understand what the other person is trying to say,
well,
which means listening.
It's
you know?
Pretty difficult in today's day and age to talk about anything beneath the surface relating to race or sex.
Yeah, but I think, well, yes, basically that. But
and, of course, people like you and I don't care about the repercussions.
Well, and, yeah.
And we talk about it anyway because there's it's extremely important to understand the human condition. But you're right. Somebody like Affleck will just say, you know, shut down conversation because it offends him, and that's racist. And you had mentioned one of the reasons why you wanted to talk about this topic tonight is because you read a Facebook post on my page.
Yeah.
Want to say a little something about that?
Well, I don't want to give too much away.
No, you don't have to.
But you posted some article.
Yeah.
And it was an article, it might have been true or false, but one of your Facebook friends replied, "That's insulting."
Right.
And I thought, well, that's not an appropriate answer. It's either true or it's false.
Right.
The truth can't be
right.
Insulting. Or if it's false, then you're wrong. You're grievously wrong.
Well, if it's true, then I have a problem being insulted. If it's false, then I should give reasons why I believe it's false.
Right.
Right.
But in either case,
yeah.
I'm insulted is
yeah.
not a reply to something that's either true or false.
To a claim, right.
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 I mean, if somebody called you a nasty name or something like that, or something that's obviously personal about you,
right.
That's not true.
Right. If I say somebody's name and I disparage them, okay, I can understand you don't like that and you're insulted. But regarding articles about general issues or movements or happenings, to say I'm insulted, what does that have to do with the point? In one sense, it doesn't matter your feelings.
Yes.
The question is whether what do you think about the claim?
Well, that is probably the other thing that's happening here. I think people seem to equate opinions about things with feelings.
Right.
And the progression seems to be now is that you really, if you want to state something, you need to state it with a strong feeling that makes it a strong opinion. If you're like, it's the outrage culture that's coming into play here. I don't know if you're following me. You're giving me
well, you're saying it. No, just say it in one sentence in like just clear language.
Well, people seem to equate opinions with feelings.
I know that.
And it seems now, because they're doing that, they seem to think that they need to intensify their feelings about a particular matter.
Because then their opinions will be more listened to?
It seems to be,
That's bizarre.
But I think that's what we're seeing. You know, I'm not saying it's logical.
Right.
I'm saying this
So truth, content, and reason have taken a back seat.
To
passions and feelings.
Right. So if I am...
In other words, we're becoming more and more like animals.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. We're
yeah.
we're disregarding the reasoning faculties
right,
that
right.
we have.
What makes us human.
We're,
yes.
we're reduced to the lower passions, our feelings about particular things, and we get insulted. We say, I'm outraged by what you said,
right.
rather than saying you're wrong because of X, Y, or Z.
And hence we've created this whole safe zone culture in colleges and universities
right.
and all of that nonsense. Now, why would I be so hurt by something somebody says? If it isn't directly, you know, directed towards me as an individual with my name attached to it.
Well, I think their side of things would
yeah.
be that he's thinking in a wrong way.
So what?
Well, I think they think that they're being scientific or whatever. They think that they're thinking intelligently, but rather they're going toward the thing which I think they wouldn't like anyways, is that they're acting in the worst caricature of faith that there is. There's an orthodoxy and a heresy to these sorts of things that they have.
Wait. Are you saying that most people who react reactionarily, emotionally, without using reason, are secular humanist progressives, and that they have a certain dogma?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not saying it's exclusively them.
Right. But is that what you're saying by there is certain dogmas, and if you go outside of that realm of thinking, if you talk about issues relating to race or sex, particularly on the opposites or the
if you talk in opposition to
their secular dogma, then you will be
a heretic.
You will be a heretic, and you need to be yelled at and disparaged.
Yes, I think that's a lot of what I'm seeing.
So, in other words, what secularists are basically saying today is what they're doing today is exactly what, like you said earlier, what they accuse fundamentalist religious people of doing that they actually don't do anymore.
I think there certainly are religious fundamentalists, but I think I meant it intentionally when I said that they are acting in the worst caricature of religion that they present.
Right.
And I don't know that I see that caricature really anywhere realistically, except with these people who are secular.
Right. Right. That's where it's played out.
It seems to be played out. They act out in the way that they accuse other people of acting.
And some of the most obvious examples are what happens on college campuses when a so-called conservative speaker comes. They're shouted down. They can't speak.
Right.
Sometimes they throw tomatoes at them or whatever they do. It's really absurd.
Well, I want to introduce this one thing. There's Jonathan Haidt. He's actually a liberal sociologist, psychologist type of person. And one of the things that he's discovered, and I don't want to say that this is exclusively a liberal or left-leaning sort of problem. It's just he's looked at those, and what he found is that conservatives understand the liberal arguments better than the liberals understand the conservative arguments. If he presented a test to people, and he said, okay, to conservatives, he said, I want you to present a liberal argument as they would present it.
Yeah.
And he went to the liberals, and he said, I want you to present a conservative argument as they would present it.
Right.
And what he found was that the conservatives really got the liberals right, but the liberals were totally wrong on what the conservatives were saying.
In my experience, I'm not the slightest bit surprised. To me, that's obvious. Liberals don't understand conservative arguments.
They refuse.
Conservatives understand liberal arguments, but recognize its wrongness.
Yeah, well, going outside of rightness or wrongness, what it's telling me is that the liberals have gotten themselves into a bubble. They're not really experiencing. They're not really able to talk about both sides of the argument. They're only able to understand their own side of the argument.
Why? Let's get beneath the surface here. Why do they remain in the bubble? Is it the fear of truth? Is that the bottom line here?
It could be. The other thing is that they never allow themselves to be exposed to something outside
Why?
Of them.
Why? It must be fear.
Well, it could be true for some people.
But all right, give me another possibility.
Well, that they've never.
There you go again. But why? Why do they keep themselves there?
Because they have a culture that you have a culture. It's so easy to remain within the liberal bubble into academia. If you go to a college, a liberal is unlikely to be challenged in his ideas. You know, things that he's been taught from the very, very beginning. So I don't want to say everybody is afraid of the truth. It may be just that the circumstances they're in, they've never had a broad education that exposed them to something outside of their bubble.
Okay, I understand you're saying that some people are invincibly ignorant of anything, anything outside of their bubble because they were brought up and formed that way.
Yeah.
Okay, I understand that, and I don't give as easy a pass to people regarding that, because I really think that the natural endowment of human reason that every human being has is able to rise above what they've been formed in and to judge it according to whether it's true or not. And I think a lot of people perhaps just say no to that voluntarily because they're too comfortable where they're at.
Yeah. One of the practices here, I wanted to get into something very practical here, is
yeah, we only have about two minutes. Go
okay.
Ahead.
One of the things that has been done by philosophers, these older classical scholastics, what they did is they often presented arguments or questions, and what they did is they presented the best arguments they could find for the opposition.
Right, the opposition.
Before
right.
they even got to their own position.
Like St. Thomas of Summa.
Right.
Yeah.
And so they knew as best as they could what the other sides of the argument yeah. were, and what they did is they tried to discern what is wrong. Like Aristotle, yeah. he found one set of early pre-Socratics saying there's no change,
right.
and on the other side he found pre-Socratics who were saying everything
all
is changed.
All there is change.
All
right.
there is
everything's
change.
In flux.
And what he did, because to us that's stupid. I think most people would say those are stupid conclusions, but instead
two stupid extremes.
He looked at both of those extremes and he discerned and he said, well, this is right because of this and this is right because of that.
Mm.
Here's where the error is.
Right.
And then presented a kind of a synthesis between these two radical extreme positions.
So there seems to be a bottom line here that we need, this is a call out to everybody, we need to rise above the culture and the upbringing that we were brought into and formed into. We absolutely have to do that in order to truly be, to truly flourish as an individual.
Right. We need to be open to somebody else's ideas. It doesn't mean that you accept those ideas.
Not only somebody else's ideas, but your own ideas that are different from the culture's ideas.
Right. A little skepticism and discernment and reflection helps.
Reflection, contemplation, silence. You hear the voice of truth echoing through the ages, the voice of God, if you will, in silence. We don't have enough of that today, Bob.
That's true.
Contemplation. Shut off the electronic noise and be silent a little bit.
But continue to listen to BTS.
But continue to listen to BTS. Forget the silence between 10 and 11. Thank you, everybody. Thanks again for another week of Beneath the Surface. Paul Morano here with my guest this week, Bob LeBlanc. Join us for another edition next week. Stay tuned for Cindy's Vinyl Vault. Have a great week, everybody.
Introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.